negative stereotypes about old age are really hard to avoid in our culture. And it starts early with TV cartoons that show older characters to be helpless or clueless. What about those celebrations of the 100th day of school that encourage kids to dress up like an elderly person, complete with cane or walker, struggling to see or hear clearly? Those beliefs have an effect on how older folks are perceived, which is problem enough. But if we accept that they're accurate, they might also rob years from our lives. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Becca Levy is professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and professor of psychology at Yale University. A lot of her research has focused on the ways age beliefs can shape our lives, hurting our self-esteem, assuming poor health is inevitable, and ultimately, this is kind of terrifying, turning into a self-fulfilling prophecy of decline as we age. But Levy's investigations have also turned up good news. Changing our beliefs about later life can affect our strength and vitality as much as eating right and exercising, and might even help ward off dementia. Her book is called Breaking the Age Code, How Your Beliefs About Aging Determine How Long and Well You Live. Becca, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. Great to join you.
So when you were in graduate school, you won this fellowship to live in Japan for a semester. How did you realize the differences in longevity between Japan and the United States might be about more than just diet and genetics?
Yes, that's a good question. So the impetus for the research and for the ideas of the book started, as you said, when I had an opportunity to go to Japan as a graduate student. And I went there with the goal of trying to understand why Japan has the longest lifespan in the world. And the first thing that I noticed when I arrived was how differently it seemed that the older people in the community were treated than what I was used to seeing in the United States. So I was used to seeing many examples of ageism, as you talked about at the beginning of our discussion. So I was really struck by how differently it seemed like the older people in Tokyo and Japan were being treated. So I noticed that they were treated as rock stars on television. The centenarians and super centenarians were on these reality shows and treated like celebrities. And they have a national holiday, which honors and celebrates older people. And I became really interested in the possibility that one of the reasons they have such a long lifespan is because of how they're treated and these age beliefs in the culture. So that sparked this whole set of studies, which I describe in the book, that document and examine how it's possible that these cultural beliefs can actually impact our aging health.
Even menopause symptoms are different in Japan, broadly speaking?
Yes, there's been some research by medical anthropologists that have found that symptoms are different in different parts of the world. And as you said, they found that in Japan, there tended to be less physical symptoms of menopause. And one of the thoughts of the medical anthropologists was it's in part due to how older women are treated and how it's thought of as sort of a natural part of the life cycle and not medicalized. So they thought that those beliefs might actually contribute to differences in experiences of menopause. And there was actually a parallel study of another medical anthropologist who looked at older men and found similarly that in Japan, older men who tend to be also treated with respect and admiration and integrated in a better way, that they had higher levels of testosterone than in other cultures that were considered. So there does seem to be a number of biomarkers. It's not just lifespan, but also health span, which may be impacted by these beliefs.
What can stereotype embodiment theory predict about the effect age biases will have on us?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that. So stereotype embodiment theory is a framework that I developed to try to make sense of how it's possible that these cultural age beliefs can get under our skin or actually impact our physiology. And it has, it's based on a lot of different studies that our lab has conducted and other groups have conducted. And it also makes predictions about what we might look at in the future. But some of the things that it looks at, for example, are we outline different mechanisms of how it can occur. So one is that it can happen implicitly or without our awareness. And we know that if that happens, if we're impacted by these cultural age beliefs, and they can actually have an impact on our aging health, but we don't see it happening, it's happening unconsciously or implicitly without our awareness, it's hard to prevent it from happening. And so that's one of the findings that I talk about in the book, is how it's really important to switch that and increase our awareness, because once we become aware of it, we can actually fend it off and prevent it from happening.
Not everybody ends up a prisoner of age biases, right? Especially if they challenge the common thinking starting early on. What can we learn from people like Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks?
Yeah, so there are some wonderful people that I had a chance to talk to and think about for the book. And so, for example, as you said, Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner, they are examples of people who had this wonderful friendship into their later life and have gone beyond the average lifespan. And I think in part that is because they have these taken in these positive age beliefs. So even though they may live in a culture that has these negative messages about aging, they've managed to navigate that and develop skills to embrace aging and embrace vitality in later life. So they're great examples. And I went back to, they had this great comedic show that about the 2,000-year-old man, which you may know about. There's some great recordings of it. And so as young men, they actually developed this great character of this older man who was, just a very sort of took on life with a great sense of humor. But also part of the humor of it was that he was able to navigate these really tricky situations and with, these great strategies, which is one of the skills that seems to go up in later life, is the ability to resolve conflicts and come up with creative strategies. So they actually developed that as part of their comedic routine, going back and forth between them at a younger age. And I think that it probably served them well as they got older.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, they certainly weren't, I don't think, developing this character so that they would live long and incredibly productive lives. But they, in their 20s and 30s, I guess, were thinking through, what would a really clever, really old person look and sound and act like?
Exactly. So I think, they're a great example of using humor and comedy and the arts to actually benefit these age beliefs and develop these role models and skills that can serve them well as they get older.
I want to talk about a phrase that is so common that I think people don't really think of themselves as holding ageist beliefs when they use it necessarily. How does the phrase senior moment plant the idea that mental decline is somehow inevitable as we get older?
Senior moment, right, is one of those terms, I'm glad you brought it up, that is very common, I think, in our culture. And people use it to describe being forgetful, at any age. But the problem with it is that it connects this forgetfulness with aging itself. And we know that people can be, forgetful at any time in their lives. We also know that there's many reasons for being forgetful. It could be that somebody was distracted, they were looking at something on their phone when somebody was talking to them, so they didn't take in the information originally, they didn't encode it. It could be that they were stressed or had different emotional events that were prevented them from taking in the information or retrieving it in an effective way. So there's lots of different reasons that people may be forgetful. And I think we also know from research that there's lots of memories that types of cognition that stay the same in later life. So like the ability to remember how to like ride a bike, for example, and there's other types of memory that actually improve in later life, or types of cognition. So for example, metacognition, or the ability to think about thinking, is something that some studies have found can improve in later life. So the science shows that this idea of connecting, all types of forgetfulness with aging just isn't supported by much of the science. And it also can be harmful because it's conveying a message of sort of inevitable decline, which we know from the research is not a good thing. But again, we can reverse it. So it's not set in stone. It's not something that the message itself isn't necessarily going to cause harm, especially if we question it and think about the science that shows that it's not necessarily the case.
It is fascinating that if, in our mid-20s, we forget a doctor's appointment or a friend's birthday, we think, oh, I was so busy, or I should have written that down. If the same thing happens to folks in their 60s, it's almost like the whole culture encourages them to think, wait, am I slipping? Well, I would have remembered this 20 years ago.
Exactly. I think you're totally right. So I think that ability to think about multiple causes of something that goes wrong is something that is easier to do at a younger age before there are these messages that, you know, connect any kind of problems with aging itself. And so I think that's actually an important message in the book, is that it's good to sort of question all the different factors that can go into something going wrong, including ageism itself. So we know that the structural ageism itself can contribute to some of the problems that people experience in later life. So by identifying some of those structural causes, I think it could serve us very well.
Tell us about this study you did comparing deaf Americans, hearing Americans, and mainland Chinese citizens, and what that taught you about attitudes and destiny.
Right. So when I was starting this research, so as I mentioned, I had this trip to Japan, which, you know, opened up my eyes to the possibility that culture could play a role. And so one of the ways that I tried to break that down and try to see if that's really what's going on with conducting a study was I designed a study to look at older people and younger people in three different cultures. So one was mainland Chinese culture, one was the American deaf culture, and then the third was sort of the mainstream American hearing culture. And our thought was that the reason that we looked at those cultures is that there's been these anthropological investigations that have found that the mainland Chinese culture and the deaf American culture are particularly age positive. So they tend to have a lot of positive age beliefs that are built into the culture. So I thought if I could find cultures that have more positive age beliefs, it would, if in fact there's some association between these cultural beliefs and how we actually experience aging health and memory, that we would see an association in those cultures. So the cultures that have more positive age beliefs should have better memory performance of the older individuals. And that's actually exactly what we found. So we found that in the most positive age beliefs were expressed in mainland China, and they had the best, the older people had the best memory performance that we looked at. And then the American deaf culture, which also had age positive beliefs, but not quite as positive as in mainland China, but still very positive, they had the second most positive age beliefs and the second highest memory scores. And then unfortunately, the mainstream American had the most negative age beliefs and the worse memory performance. So there was this association between performance and the cultural beliefs.
And at the time you did this study, the deaf American adults that you interviewed had been raised before every TV show was closed captioned. In other words, they weren't necessarily exposed to the same kinds of messages as the mainstream hearing audience.
Exactly. So that was also part of the reason that we thought we might see a difference, is just that they were not as necessarily exposed to some of the negative messaging. And then they also have a very age-positive intergenerational culture. So the deaf Americans that we studied, a lot of them attended these deaf clubs, which brought together people of all different ages.
Becca, when you say that aging is a biological process, but also a deeply social and psychological one, what do you mean exactly?
Well, we know from different studies that only about 25% of aging, health, and longevity is determined by our genes. So that means that 75% is due to environmental factors or psychological factors, including age beliefs. So that's something that I'm particularly interested in are the part of that environmental contribution that can that we can actually have an impact on, that can impact aging health.
What did you learn about how certain kinds of skills, like there's an example in the book of someone who likes to forage for mushrooms, actually improving as we get older if we keep practicing them?
Oh, right. Yes, I'm glad you brought up. So Patrick is our mushroom hunter that I really enjoyed talking to. So I have a chapter that focuses on cognitive examples and memory examples. And so he was a great person to talk to in that he used a lot of skills in later life to become better and better at identifying thousands of different types of mushrooms. And the thing that's actually very cool about mushrooms is that, and I learned about this, for, you may already know this, but I learned about this in writing the book, is that they are, you know, there are many, many different types of mushrooms, so thousands of different types, but each type of mushroom has many different stages in development, and it can look very different depending on where it is in its development. So it takes this incredible amount of knowledge to really understand all of the complexities and subtleties of the mushroom world. And so he developed that over time and kept building on his knowledge, but also was very involved in sharing his knowledge. So he was very involved in these intergenerational teams that went out to look for the mushrooms, and he was a teacher and leader and shares his knowledge with a lot of different people. And he also, what was really wonderful in talking to him was he also has his own, you know, positive age belief. So one of the questions I sometimes ask people in interviewing them, you know, and also in some of the studies, is I ask people to describe their, you know, the first image of aging that comes to their mind. So I ask people, you know, when you think of an older person, what are the first five words or phrases that come to mind? And he immediately came up with this image of this he had two images, a very active older woman and a very active older man. The older man was a mountain biker that he had in mind, who was going down mountains. And then the woman was this a beautiful older woman who was hiking in these mountains as well. And so he had these very vibrant, active, older people in nature that I think inspired him and motivated him to be this great purveyor of, you know, of knowledge about the mushrooms.
So many people are really terrified about the possibility of developing dementia and particularly Alzheimer's disease as they get older. What did you learn about how attitudes about aging, positive attitudes anyway, might be protective against Alzheimer's, even for those of us who might carry that dreaded APOE4 gene that makes people especially susceptible?
So yes, I'm glad you asked about that. So we did conduct a study to try to see whether age beliefs might contribute to risk of developing dementia. And we used something called the Health and Retirement Survey, which is this great national data set that the National Institute on Aging and the University of Michigan have developed. And so in looking at that, we were able to identify people who were, you know, dementia-free at baseline. And we looked at the age beliefs that they had taken in from their culture, and then we examined whether they developed dementia over the next 6 years. And what we found is that those who had taken in more positive age beliefs were 40% less likely to develop dementia over the next 6 years. But in addition, as you point out, we also looked at people who had this risky gene, the APOE4 gene, which tends to increase the risk of developing dementia or Alzheimer's. And what we found was even in this group, the group that had been born with the risky gene, if they were able to develop and strengthen more positive age beliefs and express more positive age beliefs at the beginning of the study, their risk of developing dementia was also, they had also had about a 40% reduction in the likelihood of developing dementia. So I think that was really a hopeful message that we found, that even in this high risk group, if they develop positive age beliefs, their risk was lower. And in fact, it was as low as those who are not born with that risky gene, those who have been spared being born with that risky gene. So I think this is actually quite a hopeful message that, you know, we can develop these, strengthen our positive age beliefs, and they can have a good impact no matter what group we're coming from.
Do you have any hypothesis as to why that mechanism might exist?
I think in that particularly, yes, so we do, so you asked earlier about the stereotype embodiment theory, and one of the pieces of that is to look at the mechanism of how it can actually happen, that the age beliefs can impact health. And so we've looked at three different types of mechanisms. We've looked at psychological mechanisms, behavioral mechanisms, and physiological mechanisms. So the psychological mechanism might be, if somebody's taken a more positive age beliefs from their culture, they probably have a greater sense of self-mastery. That would be one kind of psychological mechanism that could lead to good health outcomes. In terms of behavioral, we've found that those who've taken more positive age beliefs are more likely to engage in positive health behaviors, more likely to eat healthy diets, are more likely to exercise, they're more likely to take prescribed medications, and we know those can all lead to good health outcomes. And then the third is physiological, which would be something like those who've taken the more positive age beliefs, we found can have lower stress biomarkers. So we've looked at, for example, cortisol levels over time. And that the stress biomarker, I think, may be the key one in some of these cognitive outcomes. So we know that people who have lower stress tend to have better cognitive outcomes over time. So I think the stress and the stress biomarker is likely the mechanism that's operating in that dementia study.
So we've talked about the possible protective factors of positive age beliefs. Becca, does it work in the other direction as well? Are people who associate aging with cognitive decline more likely to experience that decline even without a genetic susceptibility?
Yes, it does go in both directions. So we also have found evidence that those who take in more negative age beliefs tend to have the flip side of these mechanisms. So yes, as you said, we have found that those who've taken more negative age beliefs tend to have elevated stress. So we've actually found that in experimental studies, if we expose people to negative age beliefs, they tend to have a higher cardiovascular response to stress. So if they experience some kind of stressor, they tends to actually elevate. It seems like the negative age beliefs can act as a lens to actually exacerbate something stressful that happens.
Is there any reason to think older folks with mental health challenges are somehow less responsive to treatment than younger folks?
Could you say that again?
Are older people with mental health challenges any more or less responsive to mental health care than younger people?
Yes. And we do have, I had a chapter that I wrote about mental health and how age beliefs come into mental health care. And yes, so older people are as responsive, if not more responsive, to mental health care. So that was actually something that was really eye-opening. And it's actually something that, you know, when I was just getting started in the field and trying to figure out what I wanted to do for my career, my first job was actually working on a geriatric unit of a mental health hospital. So it was actually the only job I could find when I got out of college. I was looking for something that would somehow use a little bit of my psychology degree. And I thought it would be interesting to work at this mental health hospital near where I lived. And the only position that was open was in this geriatric unit. And I really didn't want to take the position at first. I thought, oh, this is going to be so depressing. Is this going to be, you know, one case after another of people not getting better? And I thought I would give it, you know, 2 weeks. And I was really, it was very eye-opening, I would say, being there, because I realized how when there's good care for older people, that they really can benefit in many different kinds of ways. And it also taught me how many factors go into mental health. So we know as people get older, they get more distinguished from each other. There's more complicated pieces that go into people's makeup, including their mental health. And so I was really inspired by the team I worked with, which was multidiscipline, coming from many different disciplines, to try to understand how to improve mental health in later life. And they had some great successes with people. So a lot of people really benefited from both the pharmacological and the talking therapies, or really trying to get to the bottom of issues that they were experiencing. And I think one of the reasons that they actually often would do so well with some of the treatments was, I think there is some research that suggests as people get older, they're better at life review or giving meaning to different parts of their earlier life. And I think that can actually serve people, you know, well as they try to work on their mental health.
Becca, most people listening are probably thinking, okay, I want to hold positive beliefs about aging. But then the whole culture doesn't necessarily support this, right? Even as global lifespans, with the exception of, you know, the past couple of years with COVID and opioids, even as global lifespans are expanding, so much of the reporting on this is about how all these people who are surviving into much older age than they once did are a burden on resources, right? And should just get off the planet to make way for younger people.
Yes, so there is a lot of negative messaging out there. But something that I felt was really important to include in the book is I present about 15 evidence-based tools that people can pick up that they can start at any age that can help them sort of navigate some of these negative messages, as you were saying. So the ideal would be that we would change society, that we would create a more age-just society, that we wouldn't have ageism and this negative messaging about aging. But until that happens, I think it's important for us to think about the skills that can help us become aware of that negative messaging and then also challenge it and strengthen some of the positive age beliefs that we have encountered in our own lives, or we can go look for them as well.
Why is a lot of intergenerational contact good for developing and maintaining positive age beliefs?
Right. So intergenerational contact, particularly when the generations are working together on meaningful shared activities, has been found to be one of the best ways to overcome negative age beliefs and then strengthen positive age beliefs. And I think part of that is just getting to know people that defy the stereotypes. So often I think when people come together and they have these shared goals, they can realize that there's strengths that kind of go against some of the negative messages. And you know, so there's been research, for example, that has looked at intergenerational work teams, and they've found that when teams have people of different generations that come together, they actually are more innovative and more productive. So I think part of that is that people of different generations can often give each other skills and bring out the best in each other. And then also they can recognize that there can be sort of mentorship opportunities and, you know, going both directions. So I think younger people can offer some of the things that they know about their skills to older people, and older people can offer some of their experiences and skills and strengths to the younger people. And I think we also know that mentorship or teaching can sometimes be really beneficial for the mentor themselves. So I think all of those things go together and can really promote more positive age beliefs.
Speaking of challenging common stereotypes, something that I think will really stick with me from the book is this. I think the assumption is that musicians listen to music really loud when they're quite young, destroy their hearing, and then spend their older years struggling to hear well. You actually found research that discovered older musicians have better oral acuity than the average person because they've spent a lifetime listening carefully.
Yeah, so there is some great research that has shown that musicians can be particularly older musicians that can have these really good skills, particularly of identifying sounds when there's a lot of other noise that's happening in the background. So they're often have a lot of strength. And I think part of that is, you know, experience, but also one of the things that was fun to write about. So as you talked about, I do write about musicians. I have a chapter that I wrote about creative older people and how creativity can show a lot of patterns of growth in later life. And part of that was part of what I really enjoyed in writing that chapter was I got to interview and find out about a lot of different artists. And one of the aspects of some of the musical communities, which is goes back to what we just were talking about with these intergenerational ties, is there can be these musical cultures that really respect the older musicians and give a lot of value to the older musicians. There can be a lot of intergenerational mentorship experiences within musical communities. So I think that also can strengthen and benefit different types of age beliefs, and in turn seems to maybe have an impact on hearing. And so we actually have an experimental study in which we found, it was a longitudinal study, and we did find over time that those who had taken in more positive age beliefs had better hearing performance than those who had taken in more negative age beliefs. So there seems to be some connection between these cultural age beliefs and then actually auditory experiences.
Yeah, to the whole anti-aging industry, Becca, reading this book made me think about the fact that we hear anti-aging so often as a selling point for everything from clothing to cosmetics, everything, that we don't stop and question the assumptions there. If suddenly we all got a flood of marketing about, like, this is an anti-left-hand product, this product is going to convert you from being left-handed to being right-handed, I think people might take umbrage at that and recognize that there's no particular reason we need to try to not be left-handed, instead be right-handed.
Exactly. I love that. I think that's, yeah, that I like that thinking about the left hand versus right hand. 'Cause I think actually something that that I include in the book is sometimes a way to think about whether something is ageist is think about, how would that sound if it were applied to another group such as women. So, if you said all women should leave the workforce because they're, a burden on the workplace, like it would sound terrible, and people would say, no, that's awful. You can't say that. That's very sexist. And I think sometimes there's messaging about aging, and because of a lot of, because I think the World Health Organization has said ageism is the most prevalent and the most socially accepted form of prejudice. And part of that, I think, what happens is that we hear this negative messaging, and people say, like, yeah, okay, well, I guess that makes sense. And it's harder to question it if you don't have the skills to think about, when is that really fair? Do all older people act in that way? Are they really all a burden? Is there another way to think about it? I think is a really important step that we can all take.
So we're all, at least in this country and culture, pretty steeped in the age biases that have existed here for a long time. I think it's fair to say most of us want that bonus 7.5 years that positive ideas about aging might give us. It's one thing to say, okay, I should from here on out have more positive attitudes about aging. What does it take to actually internalize those and really turn the corner from this foreboding about aging to being excited about aging?
Well, I think it takes some work, but I think I'll do it. So I think there's some research that suggests that to really like change a habit, you have to do something at least 3 times. And so I think in the book, I do present different types of tools that we can take on that can help. And so, for example, something that I think can be quite powerful is something called age belief journaling. So what that involves is just, for 1 week writing down every portrayal of aging that you encounter, whether it be like in social media, on streaming your favorite show on Netflix, conversation that you overhear around the Thanksgiving table or whatever it is. I mean, any time that you hear something about aging over that week, write it down and then mark whether it's positive or negative. And if it's negative, take a moment and think, is it possible that there could have been a different portrayal of aging that was presented in that television show I just watched? And could the cranky older principal actually been presented as a wise older principal who's offering knowledge to the students? So taking that moment of noticing if it's positive or if it's negative. And then the third piece is to notice when they're absent. So we know when there's an absence of a group that can lead to marginalization of that group. So if you watch a show and everybody's under the age of 20, write that down. And we have found that in 1 week, by writing down all those examples of portrayal of aging and sort of questioning them and noticing when they're absent, that can be a really powerful tool to start to flip the narrative around and become aware of the age messaging and then to sort of take control of it.
Becca Levy is professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and professor of psychology at Yale University. Her book is called Breaking the Age Code: How Your Beliefs About Aging Determine How Long and Well You Live. Becca, this has been really interesting. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at the handle KERA Think. If you want to subscribe to the podcast, it's free where you get podcasts. You just have to search for KERA Think to find it. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.